From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Al Gore has said he will decide by the end of the year whether to run again for president. In the meantime, he and his wife Tipper are back in the public eye, giving interviews for their new book, Joined at the Heart, The Transformation of the American Family. On today's Fresh Air, a conversation with Al and Tipper Gore. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Child of My Heart, the new novel by Alice McDermott. And music critic Milo Miles reviews the reissue of the Nonesuch Explorer series, originally released from 1967 to 84. It was the first series to collect high-fidelity recordings of music from around the world. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush is in Prague for a NATO summit and will discuss the UN efforts to disarm Iraq. The president will seek support should he think military action against Saddam Hussein becomes necessary. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Prague.
The president is not expected to ask for a formal NATO endorsement of a possible war with Iraq. In an interview with Czech TV, he said it's too early for that discussion. But if military action is needed, he says he hopes individual NATO nations will join the U.S.
They will realize it's in the interest of peace and stability that that happen. But, we're not close to that decision point yet because we're just beginning the process of allowing Saddam the chance to show the world whether or not he will disarm.
White House officials insist that Iraq will not dominate this NATO summit, saying the primary focus will be the future of NATO and its expansion. Seven nations, including Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, will be invited to join the alliance. Don Gagne, NPR News, traveling with the president in Prague.
Emergency officials say an oil tanker broke in two and sank today off the coast of northwest Spain, threatening to spill more than 20 million gallons of fuel oil. The tanker was abandoned by its crew last week after it began to break up in a storm. Salvage crews towed it out to sea in an effort to limit contamination from the more than 1 million gallons of oil that had already spilled. Experts say it's possible that the fuel could solidify and stay put at nearly 12,000 feet under the sea. But environmentalists say the ship is like a time bomb that could eventually release twice as much oil as was spilled from the Exxon Valdez in Alaska in 1989. Israel's center-left Labor Party has chosen the leader. Preliminary results show the dovish former general Amram Mitzna won today's primary. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Amram Mitzna, the mayor of the city of Haifa, is pinning his electoral hopes on ending the two-year-old conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. Mitzna today said that if he wins national elections in January, he will immediately dismantle all Jewish settlements in Gaza and reopen negotiations with the Palestinians. He also said that if there's no agreement after a year, he would order a unilateral Israeli withdrawal from most of the occupied West Bank. The Speaker of the Palestinian Parliament, Abu Allah, welcomed Mitzna's victory and said that in a short time he has delivered a clear and important message on the need for peace. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's Likud party holds its own primaries next week. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 12 points to close at 8,474 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 19 points, or 1.3%. It closed at 1,374. The S&P 500 lost 3 to close at 896. This is NPR News. The Senate is expected to cast final votes tonight on a bill creating a Department of Homeland Security. Earlier today, Republicans defeated a Democratic amendment that would have stripped out seven provisions the Democrats said were gifts to special interests friendly to the GOP. A group of young people who allegedly beat a man to death in Milwaukee this fall could cost their parents thousands of dollars under a civil lawsuit filed today. Chuck Quernbach reports from Wisconsin Public Radio.
15 children or young adults already face criminal charges in the so-called mob beating of Charlie Young Jr. Now Young's mother has okayed a civil lawsuit against most of the alleged attackers and their parents. Young's attorney, Tom Jacobson, says his client wants to teach some personal accountability.
The individual's got to be held accountable, and the parent, if they're minors, have to be held accountable. Not society.
Jacobson says the lawsuit would limit the accused and their parents from trying to profit from the case. but an attorney who represents one of the miners says his client's family is poor and has never talked about trying to raise any money by selling their story. Also named in the lawsuit are two child care agencies that apparently had foster care responsibility for one of the alleged attackers. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Quernbach in Milwaukee.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan said today that the global economy has become more flexible, allowing it to absorb shocks such as the September 11th attacks and the U.S. stock market slide. Greenspan told the Council on Foreign Relations the U.S. economy is still growing even after losing about $8 trillion in the stock markets. The Fed chief cautioned, though, that the world economy is still weak. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and WorldCom. A financial update is now available at worldcom.com/update.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Al Gore has said that he will decide by the end of the year whether to run again for president, and he has begun to speak out on issues that he has publicly avoided for the past 2 years, like the 2000 presidential election. In Sunday's Washington Post magazine, he said that his defeat in 2000 was a crushing disappointment. He strongly disagreed with the U.S. Supreme Court decision, and that if everyone in Florida who tried to vote had had his or her vote counted properly, he would have won. Gore and his wife Tipper are now making the rounds of talk shows. The occasion is a new book they co-authored called Joined at the Heart, The Transformation of the American Family. They've also edited a book of photos of American family life called The Spirit of Family. Joined at the Heart responds to such questions as, what does it mean to be a family today? And how do we deal with all of the changes that American families have been going through in the last few decades? The Gores say they want to dispel a lot of the mythology about family that is sometimes promoted as part of some ideological agenda. I spoke with Al and Tipper Gore late yesterday afternoon. Your new book is about how the American family has changed. For example, that there's more divorce, more single-parent families, more blended families, more interreligious and interethnic marriages. Do you pass judgment on this? Does this seem morally good, bad, or neutral to you?
Well, it is what it is, and we think that diversity, for example, is a good thing, and some of the trends are good, some of them are bad, some of them are just different. But one of our points, Terry, is that the old mythology of the past has sometimes prevented families and our nation dealing on behalf of families from seeing what the reality of America, of the American family today, really is. And we do not pass judgment on the choices that families make about what kind of families they have. There are obviously some things that we do pass judgments on, but in terms of the structure of a family, increasingly most Americans feel that that the people you're closest to make up your family. Obviously, it's more than that, but that's what people feel these days.
Al Gore, you've said in the past that you support gay domestic partnerships and having legal protections for those gay relationships, but that they shouldn't have the same sacrament as marriage and that you want to protect the institution of marriage as it's been understood between a man and a woman. And I'm wondering if writing this book has made you change your mind about that and if you feel any more comfortable with the idea of gay marriage than you did before.
Well, it has caused me to reflect on it quite a bit. Of course, sacrament is for the religious institutions to determine.
Right.
The nature of the legal relationship is for the state governments to determine. And it is an issue confronting state governments. I do not think that the federal government should step in to prevent state governments from making whatever decision they wish to on that. I think that gay and lesbian partnerships should have the protections that are equivalent to the legal protections that are provided for in marriage.
I'm sorry, but do you think they should be legally allowed to get married?
I think they should have civil partnerships, civil relationships that are the equivalent of marriage. And that they should be recognized as such under the law.
But not marriage, just the equivalent of. I'm wondering if this is the kind of thing where it's just too big a political liability at this point in time to say that you support gay marriage.
The word marriage, the word marriage has traditionally had that meaning. I think that gay and lesbian partnerships should have all the protections that are afforded a marriage.
Yeah, listen, I think one thing that we've learned is in looking at the partners that are committed to each other, that have adopted children, is it fair that they can't share in each other's wills or, you know, pension rights and that kind of thing? I think most fair-minded Americans would say that's really a good question. We've also heard from a lot of our friends in the community that they're not really that interested in having marriage that's equivalent to the traditional family.
Well, some are.
Some are, but some aren't. I mean, what I'm saying to you, Terry, is that there's even some division there. So
yeah, the activist community.
We don't really make a judgment about it because we just wanted to show the Logan family and that they are a family, that they are committed, they've adopted children, they're raising the children, and, I think that family values to us means how we value families, and we're seeing families come in all different shapes and sizes, and that's what we're trying to show in this book.
I'm interested in how the families you grew up in affected the kind of parents you wanted to be and the kind of family you wanted to have. Tibor Gore, you grew up in a family where your parents divorced when you were four. You and your mother moved in with your grandparents after that, and the grandparents helped raise you. They also helped take care of your mother when she was suffering with bouts of depression. How did that affect your idea of the family you wanted when you grew up?
Well, I have to say that the whole family helped protect me. My father was always involved, and his parents, my grandparents on his side, although I did live with my mother's parents. And, you know, there was a great joy in that I had those intense relationships and learned a great deal from knowing my grandparents as well as I did. Now, there's obviously a great sadness in divorce. I mean, that's not a thing that's ever pleasant for anybody, I think. But one thing that I think I came out of that with was seriously thinking about marriage and knowing that it was a commitment that was going to be probably difficult at times, but that you don't cut and run with the first sign of a problem. I was determined to make my marriage last. I probably was more determined about that and had thought more about it than a lot of my friends because of my early experience. And being an only child, when I met Al, when we decided to get married, we used to talk about having six children, and we compromised at four. Very funny.
Al Gore, you grew up in a political family. Your father was in the Senate. Your mother worked very hard to work on his behalf. So you grew up in a political family, and then you became the father in a political family. How did your upbringing within a political family affect the kind of father you wanted to be and husband you wanted to be?
Well, apart from the public roles that my father and mother played because of my father's profession, in their private roles as mother and father, they were very loving and very attentive and involved, and that had a huge impact on me. I think all of us learn a great deal about the kinds of parents we want to be from our own parents. And my parents were married for 62 years before my father passed away a few years ago. And the all-out commitment that they had to one another made an impression on me. And one other thing, my mother was one of the first women to graduate from Vanderbilt Law School back in the 30s. My father was more than proud of her and treated her at least as an equal, and that they modeled a relationship that had a huge impact on my understanding, not only of parenting, but also of marriage.
Now, I think one of the issues you went through as a young man was whether or not you should go to Vietnam, and I believe you were opposed to the war. Your father was opposed to the war, but he was in the middle of a re-election campaign at the time that you were of draft age. And you really anguished over that, according to everything that I've read on the subject. And I believe that part of the reason why you decided to join the military, as opposed to trying to get out of the military, was because it could have had an adverse effect on your father's reelection campaign. Now, knowing that the anguish that you went through in trying to weigh what was best for you, for your country, and for your father politically, what were your thoughts about how to try to like not burden your own children with how their behavior would impact on your political career? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. First, the main reason I decided to volunteer for the Army in spite of my opposition to the war was that I was raised in two different environments. One of them, Washington, D.C., the other, a small town in Tennessee, and my draft board was located there, and it still is the kind of town where people know about it when you're born and care about it when you die, and everybody in those years knew exactly who was in the draft pool each month. And there's not the anonymity that you have in a large city, and it was going to be highly visible what I did, which in my way of thinking made it easier for me to do what I'm now convinced was the right thing. But sure, his the consequences for him also played a role. And I think that the experiences I had growing up in a political family really did help me a lot in having some understanding for and empathy for the pressures on our children that accompany a high-profile job in the public eye.
Tibor Gore, one of the issues that has been important to you personally and socially and politically in terms of your work is mental health and depression. You a few years ago, told the American public that you had suffered with chronic depression, that your mother had suffered with chronic depression. Was there a period before you... I'm sorry, go ahead. I hear you're trying to say something.
Could I just correct
that?
Yeah, my mother suffered with chronic depression. I suffered with clinical depression.
Clinical depression,
right. Which is...
Let me ask you to clarify.
Not chronic,
yeah.
Not chronic.
Right, okay. So this was this only after your son's car accident, or does it come and go?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I was in my 40s, and it was quite a different situation.
Mm-hmm. Is it something you felt you had to cover up, particularly as a political wife, before you actually went public with it?
Well, I think, first of all, the context is I think all of us have a right to have medical privacy about things that happen with us. But yes, I think mainly because of the stigma that's associated with mental health issues, which I'm dedicated to eradicating because mm-hmm. it's so unfair. That is what really caused me to... only talk about it with my family and very close friends. And I tell you, it was during the years I spent, when I was vice president, during those 8 years, I spent a lot of my time talking to teenagers around the country. And I had roundtable discussions that USA Today sponsored, some of them. And I was talking to kids in a high school, and I asked them, how many of you have ever considered suicide or know someone who has talked about it? And this was just after Columbine. And more than half of the hands went up in the class, and the teachers gasped, and I said, okay, well, have you talked to a teacher or a counselor or, gone for help or had your friend go for help? And they all paused, and there was a silence, and then a couple of them said no, and I said, why? And they said, because we don't want to be labeled. And I realized then that my silence about myself was contributing to passing the stigma on to their generation, as well as contributing to the stigma in general, and that I could do something about that. So I did, and it's been one of the most rewarding experiences of my life to have been able to talk publicly about that, and I have continued to. I'm also now chairperson of the National Mental Health Awareness Campaign, and I speak all around the country on this.
My guests are Al and Tipper Gore. They've written a new book called Joined at the Heart, The Transformation of the American Family. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Al and Tipper Gore are my guests. They have a new book called Joined at the Heart, The Transformation of the American Family. This new book not only marks a collaborative project that you've done together, I think it marks your political reemergence. You know, we haven't heard much publicly from you since the election, and I think this book is an opportunity for you to begin again to give your opinions of politics, to reflect on the election, the presidential election. And, you know, I've been trying to keep up with the things you've said in the press and what's been said about you. And in this weekend's Washington Post magazine, there's an article about you. And the writer says, you know, a lot of people say that you lost because you were too stiff. And a typical analysis was in this magazine, the Washington Post magazine. The writer says, if Gore is going to connect with the American people in another race, advisors know he needs to curb his tendency to come across as pedantic. He needs to communicate not what he thinks, but how he feels. He needs to make people love him. He also needs to say whatever it is inside himself that makes him cautious in public, closed, whatever it is that makes him fold up in front of a TV camera or get stiff and inauthentic in front of a crowd. That simple tag, stiff, has done Gore incalculable damage. Does that bug you, that you're criticized for being too smart and for coming across as pedantic when you were running for the most powerful position in the world?
I don't know. This microphone is so intimidating. I'm closing up on you, Terry.
No, but really, does it bug you that a lot of people think you lost the presidential race because you were pedantic and stiff, as opposed to because you weren't smart or because you didn't understand the way the world operates?
You know what? If I could just cut in here for a second.
Yeah.
one reason that you haven't heard from him in 18 months is just because we've been sitting across from each other in a book office writing this book.
Yeah.
And but I just want to say that I know that he lost and he's not serving, but I would like to remind everybody that he got more votes than any Democrat in history, and he got more votes than the current president.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's true. So, I mean, you have to take that into account. I mean, that's huge.
Well, let me answer your question, Terry. No, it doesn't bother me, whatever people want to, however they want to interpret my public persona. I'm the same person that I've always been, and I am who I am. And as I've grown older and gotten more experiences under my belt, I think I have become a lot more comfortable in just being real informal all the time and not worrying about the kind of formal presentation of self that was part of the tradition of politics that I came out of in Tennessee.
I still want to know, though, are you ever frustrated with American voters because sometimes the way politics is discussed, like who's the friendliest, who's the funniest, who's the most stiff or the most personal, it almost sounds as if you're voting for Mr. Personality in high school as opposed to a person who's running the country. Does that frustrate you? Are you frustrated with American voters?
No, no, I'm not. No, I'm not. And I appreciate the majority of them supporting me. So I'm not going to say that at all. And if you go back and look at American history, the kind of things that have always been said about people running for political office, you know, it's just part of the process, and you just do your best to talk about the choices that we have to make as a nation, and let the rest of it sort itself out. And that's why we're focusing on what we think is most important. And among those things is the American family and the dramatic changes it's gone through.
Tipper Gore, you know, the one of the people who you co-founded the Parents Music Resource Group with in the mid-'80s, your group that worked on behalf of getting parental advisories about sexual content and violence in lyrics on recordings. Your colleague in starting that was Susan Baker, who's the wife of James Baker. At the time, he was Secretary of the Treasury. He went on to be Secretary of State, and then he was the front person in the Bush recount in Florida. And I'm wondering what it was like for you to watch the husband of your former partner leading the recount, the Republican version of the recount against your
husband. Actually, I've always called it the first count, Terry. As I recall, I think they stopped the counting of the votes, frankly, and I don't think they were all ever counted. But, you know.
But you're over that, right?
I'm over that, yeah. But, you know, no, I just really want to, you know, make that clear, that's all, because I think it's an important point for democracy, and I think that it has nothing to do with my husband's career or James Baker's career. I mean, it's important for democracy that we understand that people tried to vote and couldn't vote or voted and didn't have their votes counted. I mean, that's important. That needs to be remembered and rectified. But I understand your question. And, you know, I'm so sorry about the fact that the bipartisan spirit has really been destroyed by the Republicans, probably starting with the Newt Gingrich. You know, we all trace it back to that. I mean, I talk to some of my Republican friends and Democratic friends now, and they talk about how the atmosphere has changed. It used to be that you could, fight your political battles and then, you know, leave that at the door, and then you were friends, and you could come together around issues. And I have always believed in working in a bipartisan way on issues. I think that serves the American people the best. And, you know, I'd like to see that spirit return, quite frankly.
Do you still speak with Susan Baker?
Oh, sure.
Al and Tipper Gore have written a new book called Joined at the Heart, The Transformation of the American Family. They've also edited a new book collecting photos of American family life called The Spirit of Family. The Gores will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Audi, the luxury car company with quattro all-wheel drive in every model line. Details at AudiUSA.com. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of I, Richard by Elizabeth George, author of A Traitor to Memory. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Al and Tipper Gore. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Child of My Heart, the new novel by Alice McDermott. And Milo Miles reviews the reissue of the Nonesuch Explorer series, the first series to collect high-fidelity recordings of music from around the world. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Al and Tipper Gore. Al Gore has said he will decide by the end of the year whether to run again for president. In the meantime, the Gores are back in the public eye, giving interviews for their new book, Joined at the Heart, The Transformation of the American Family. They've also edited a new book collecting photos of family life called The Spirit of Family. In a recent New York Times article, the reporter wrote, Mr. Gore remains, fairly or not, a symbol in many quarters of Democratic defeat and the past. However, in this past election that you did not participate in, the Democratic Party didn't do so well without you, and they surely can't blame you for those losses. You've been critiqued by your party. I wonder what your critique of your party is now. What is your critique of the Democratic Party, and what do you think they need to do to try to regain a foothold in Congress?
Well, every time I was asked that after Election Day, I pretty much had the same answer, namely that I don't want to be a Monday morning quarterback. I think that some of the leaders in the party were unfairly criticized. It's difficult for a party that doesn't have the White House to dominate the agenda the way an incumbent president can. I do think, and I've said previously, that we have to be the loyal opposition in reality and not just in name. And that means where we disagree, drawing lines clearly and defending our differences with the president boldly. And there are a lot of people who've been trying to do that. I think the party as a whole needs to do that.
Do you think the party should be heading in a more liberal or a more centrist position now?
I don't think it needs to move to the left or to the right. It needs to move forward and really take hold of the new challenges that are confronting American families.
Do you have any specific concerns about what a Republican-dominated government will push through legislatively or in the courts?
Oh, you bet.
What are your concerns?
You bet.
What are the ones on top of your list?
Well, I think that the judiciary could be really changed dramatically. I'm concerned about some aspects of this Homeland Security bill that have the potential for a massive invasion of privacy for American people and American families with a repository of information that the Pentagon wants to put together. There's been something in the press about that recently. Admiral Poindexter, who of the Iran-Contra fame, has been put in charge of designing a total information awareness to have the Pentagon collect information on every American citizen according to their draft plan. There are a lot of things that I'm worried about, but I just think that. The American family is under such pressure now from the amount of time at work, from the amount of time taken away from the family in commuting and watching television and all of the economic stress, the personal debt. I think there's a disconnect between a lot of the policy debates in Washington and the realities that are now being faced by so many families.
You supported the first President Bush in the Gulf War. Is the Bush administration now doing the right thing in pressing a war with Iraq, or do you think that the war with Iraq may hurt the war against terrorism?
I think it distracts from the attention that should properly be paid to the war against terrorism. I think that the finite resources of time and energy and money that are devoted to the task by the CIA, by the Pentagon, et cetera, should not be diluted right now. Osama bin Laden is still alive, evidently, and they've regrouped, and according to the intelligence community, they pose a threat every bit as severe now as what they posed in the weeks leading up to 9/11. And as far as we know, there's no connection between Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. And so I think that it was a mistake. Saddam's a bad guy and ought to be removed from power, but we should not lose focus, and we have.
You know, the latest Bin Laden tape, and it seems like it really is Bin Laden on that tape. That tape referred to Bush as the Pharaoh of the time and referred to him as being a pharaoh in part because he was killing Iraqis. This is the first time, to my knowledge, that Bin Laden has, you know, directly addressed the U.S. relationship with Iraq and put that on his list of grievances. Do you think that that demonstrates that this possible war with Iraq is going to drive Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden together? Or do you think that this tape implies that they've already been in league with each other?
No, I don't think that it implies either of those things. He's an opportunist. He actually has referred to Iraq previously, and he latches on to anything that he feels is a grievance in the Arab and Islamic worlds, and tries to claim that it's part of his cause. And I know of no evidence of cooperation between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. If there is such evidence, they ought to make it public. They have not made anything public, and I think they would have if they had it.
I've been reading reports in the newspapers that the CIA is at odds with Donald Rumsfeld and President Bush, and that some members of the CIA have said that they feel that they're expected to cook their reports to make them supportive of possible war with Iraq, and reports that don't support those views are ignored. I'm wondering if you've been following that and what your impressions of that rift are.
Well, I used to serve on the Intelligence Committee in the Congress, and I was an avid consumer of the daily intelligence briefings every morning for 8 years. And the importance of insulating these analysts from political pressure can't really be overstated, because there are eyes and ears, and if they are made to feel like they have to self-censor what they believe the truth is, and give tailor-made reports that don't really reflect their best judgment, that can really damage the country.
And is it your understanding that that's what's happening?
Well, I've read the same reports that
right.
you're referring to.
Right. In retrospect, are the things that you think that you and President Clinton should have done about bin Laden, or do you feel confident that you did everything you could have done? I know you were both very aware of the threat.
Well, we had an awful lot in the works. You know, we tried to get him on numerous occasions. We did not have the mobilization of American opinion that naturally took place in the aftermath of the massive attacks of September 11th. But we did quite a lot, and we had it's been printed in some national publications that we had a rather massive plan that was about to be triggered, and that was put on the shelf, according to the press reports, by the incoming administration. Now, they had a lot on their plate and all that, but could we have done more? Perhaps. That should be reviewed along with everything else. And I personally am satisfied that we did everything that was feasible to try to track this guy down and to get him. We could not send a large army into Afghanistan during the time before September 11th. It was not feasible.
Do you think that the Monica Lewinsky affair and the impeachment process interfered with any of your efforts to get bin Laden? As a distraction?
No, I don't.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't.
Okay. You said to the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco recently, if what America represents to the world is leadership in a commonwealth of equals, then our friends are legion. If what we present to the world is empire, then our enemies will be legion. Which face do you think President Bush is showing now?
Well, I think the president's to be commended for his effort in recent weeks to invest heavily in the United Nations process and for getting a unanimous Security Council vote in favor of his Iraq resolution. of course, it's read differently, apparently, by other nations in the world than the way we're reading it. But I kind of have the feeling that for whatever reasons, he shifted course and is now much more likely to take a multilateral approach. Now, I may be wrong on that, but I stand by the earlier words that you quoted from San Francisco, and I do think that we have squandered the goodwill of the world that we had in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, and now there are a lot of places in the world where they're more apprehensive about what the U.S. is likely to do. I think the recent approach in the United Nations has helped to modify that somewhat.
My guests are Alan Tipper Gore. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Al and Tipper Gore. They've written a new book called Joined at the Heart, The Transformation of the American Family.
What's it been like for both of you to have to watch from the sidelines America's political life and political direction since September 11th? Has it been frustrating to be on the sidelines and not
sure,
in,
at times.
The White House?
Yeah, at times it's been frustrating because you naturally want to get your arms around a problem and wrestle with it and try to help solve it. You know, I've made a career of a quarter century of public service, and after being in the White House for 8 years and wrestling with some of these things, it's just natural to want to pitch in. And so, yeah, but you know, that's just natural, and I don't dwell on it, but sure.
Al Gore, is there just a small part of you that is relieved that all of these burdens of terrorism and possible war with Iraq aren't on your shoulders?
No, not a bit. It makes me more eager to contribute what I can to help my country, and I do miss that. But you know, there are many ways to serve. I don't know if I'll ever be a candidate again or not, but whether I am or not, I want to have an impact on public policy because I feel strongly about what should be done.
I actually have a couple of TV questions for each of you. One for Tipper. Did you watch the VH1 movie in which Mariel Hemingway played you? That was about your time as head of the Parents Music Resource Center.
I did not watch it.
Intentionally didn't want to see it?
I didn't have time. I mean, I was aware of it. I knew about it. I was told about it. But I didn't have time. We were too busy trying to cull down from 15,000 images, 256 photos that we have in Spirit of Family, which show the book.
Yeah, we haven't watched a lot of television in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
However, Al Gore, you're really about to be on television on Saturday Night Live. You're going to be hosting one night in December.
Yeah.
Why are you doing it?
I've always enjoyed that show since it came on, and I was invited, and I thought, why not? You know, my attitude is sort of summed up in the Kris Kristofferson lyric, "Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose," and it sounded to me like it would be fun, so I'm headed that way.
Tipper Gore, your husband's deciding whether to run for the presidency or not. I'm sure it's something you're talking about a lot. Would you want to be first lady? I mean, would you welcome that position?
Well, actually, you know, to tell you the truth, we're really not talking a lot about it. We've been talking a lot about these two books that we've been writing, and now, obviously, trying to talk about the book. And we have not talked about the decision that he says he is going to make by January. And that means that we will talk about it probably over the holidays, and we'll get our family together, and we will really, you know, air everything and give him our best advice And then I think he will, as he usually does with very tough decisions, sort of go to his mountaintop or whatever he does, and he comes back and says what he's going
to
do.
It's been easier for us, Terry, to just push off the wrestling with that decision until the holidays, because we've got so much else on our plate, and it's just easier to push it off and sit down and make the decision at that time. That's what I said 2 years ago that I was going to do. It's sort of like telling yourself you're going to wake up at a particular time in the morning, and then you do. And that's sort of the way I've approached this decision, and we've just been concentrating on writing these books.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, Terry. We appreciate it.
Yes, thank you so very much.
Al and Tipper Gore have written a new book called Joined at the Heart, The Transformation of the American Family. They've also edited a new book of photos of American family life called The Spirit of Family. Novelist Alice McDermott won the National Book Award for her last novel, Charming Billy. In McDermott's new novel, Child of My Heart, she turns from the subject of adults acting like children to children pushed too soon into some realities of adulthood that must be met with stoicism. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Here's a chicken-egg question. Is it a natural act of homage and chutzpah for contemporary American novelists to try to rewrite The Great Gatsby? Or is the power of Gatsby so great that it just seeps into and, in effect, rewrites so many contemporary American novels? The Gatsby tributes, satires, and updates actually began almost as soon as the novel was published in 1925, when F. Scott Fitzgerald's good friend, Nathaniel West, started writing The Day of the Locust, his own vicious version of the quest for the American dream embodied in A Golden Girl. The latest literary doff of the hat to Gatsby comes from Alice McDermott, whose lovely new novel, Child of My Heart, resurrects a few of Gatsby's charmed ingredients. A retrospective story bounded by the space of a single summer that takes place out on the playgrounds of the fabulously rich on Long Island. There's even a girl named Daisy, though she's more black and blue than golden. These are just grace notes, not a conscious effort on McDermott's part to replay the whole of Gatsby. McDermott's novel goes off in an altogether different direction, and of course she's much less of a WASP wannabe than Fitzgerald was, more upfront about her Irish Catholic preoccupation with guilt, class consciousness, and paradises lost through all too human bungling. The narrator of Child of My Heart is named Teresa, and she's looking back on the summer of her 15th year, sometime in the early 1960s. Teresa is the only daughter of older parents. She's also beautiful. People tell her she's a young Elizabeth Taylor or Jackie Kennedy. Consequently, a few years before the novel opens, her parents decided to move out to the far eastern end of Long Island to give Teresa the opportunity to meet rich boys. The quality, though, that really distinguishes Teresa is that she's not nice, in a smart way. She's already sized up the world, her family, and her own power, especially over men. Teresa works as a pet tender and babysitter. She enchants her small charges, as well as some of their fathers. One of those lightly lecherous fathers is a famous painter in his 70s, a spattering of Jackson Pollock and Pablo Picasso here, whose wife has just deserted him and their toddler. Tagging along on these babysitting jobs is Teresa's favorite cousin, Daisy, an anemic redhead who's visiting for a few weeks to escape a cramped household of brothers and sisters back in Queens. On the first afternoon of Daisy's visit, Teresa spots purplish bruises on the insteps of both of her cousin's feet. Those ominous bruises fade, but then appear on other parts of Daisy's body. The two girls, shaman and acolyte, enter into a silent complicity with the old goat of an artist to keep Daisy's bruises to themselves and keep her vacation going. Salt water, St. Joseph's aspirin, and a cheap pair of Mary Janes covered with sparkles constitute the cure regimen at Teresa's seaside clinic. Inevitably, however, nosy bodies, sex, and wayward children and dogs intrude, and Pop, This magical moment out of time and death disintegrates into memory. Child of My Heart reads with the quick shift intensity of a short story. As she has in her other novels, McDermott renders her characters in spare sentences that instantly summon up whole lives. Consider this miniature portrait of one of Teresa's wealthy employers. Mrs. Richardson was one of those blunt, loud, bangs-across-the-forehead women who seemed to believe that everyone else must surely be as pleased with her as she was with herself for being so no-nonsense and direct and, as she saw it, egalitarian. But more than character or plot, this is a novel that's distinguished by mood, by its elegiac longing for a vanished beloved who couldn't be saved. I know a couple of prominent book critics have already weighed in negatively against Child of My Heart, saying it's not as compelling as McDermott's other novels. I liked it a lot, but then a novel told by a cynical Catholic girl who can't forgive herself for being a cynical Catholic girl would be right up my alley.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Child of My Heart by Alice McDermott. Coming up, the reissue of the Nonesuch Explorer series of music from around the world. This is Fresh Air. From 1967 to 1984, Nonesuch Records released a series of 92 albums of music from around the world. The Explorer series, as it was called, is now being reissued by region, starting with 13 CDs from Africa. Critic Milo Miles takes a look at the nature of musical exploration then and now.
When I was a teenager, every record store indicated that music from other countries was unimportant. Foreign music albums had cruddy covers. They were dusty and stuck in the back. The only people who bought them must have been immigrants. The Nonesuch Explorer series changed all that. The covers are bright and lively, with intriguing art and a look of something both hip and professional. The terrific 2LP sampler could provide a first exposure to Indonesian gamelan, Japanese wooden flute, and African thumb piano. But the hard truth was, a lot of the Explorer records were not much fun to listen to as whole LPs. By the time the series ended in 1984, it seemed like a relic from the world before world music. The recent reissue of all 13 of the Explorer albums devoted to Africa puts the series to the test of time, but the truth has not changed. You could learn something from every album here, but records should offer joyful wisdom. Those you listen to because they are good for you are records you don't listen to much. Now, there's no question that tracks such as this one from East Africa, witchcraft and ceremonial music, has the exciting ancient but avant-garde effect that music crossing cultures sometimes does. CDs from the African series most suitable for a general audience are the three devoted to the mbira, or thumb piano music, of the Shona people in Zimbabwe. In fact, one of these reissues, The Soul of Mbira, is a grand classic of world music. Compelling to this day, it has punch, drive, and vitality that needs no translation.
Back in 1973, the soul of Mbira helped prepare me for the marvelous electric protest songs of Thomas Mapfumo that appeared in the United States 10 years later. I doubt Thomas Mapfumo, with his amplifiers and rock soul modernism, would find a place in the Nonesuch Explorer series. And that's its greatest limitation. There is precious little other than pure folk music or classical traditions. It feels like the Explorer series focused on villagers but left out the city kids and, well, the obvious superstars. The only example of pop music in the series is a pleasant but undistinguished highlife band from Ghana. It's a pity there isn't more pop, because great modernist masters of African music were drawing huge crowds in their home countries when the Explorer series was recorded. And for the most part, they were no better represented in the West than the traditional performers. Imagine groundbreaking albums from King Sunny Ade, Franco, Dr. Nico, and even the brilliant progressive folklorist Francis Bebe. Any of these could have captivated Western music fans and sold well enough to expand the series as a whole. The Nonesuch Explorer series was smart and visionary. If it had been just a bit more far-seeing, it could now be promoted as prophecy, not nostalgia.
Milo Miles lives in Cambridge. He reviewed the reissue of the Explorer series on the Nonesuch label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chilog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Universal Pictures, presenting The Emperor's Club, starring Kevin Kline. In every person's life, there is someone who makes all the difference, now in theaters everywhere. From Harcourt, publisher of Life of Pi by Yann Martell, a modern-day adventure story. And Nonesuch Records and Travelogue, the new album by Joni Mitchell, a 2-CD set featuring new recordings of 22 songs spanning her entire career, accompanied by full orchestra. Available at Barnes & Noble. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Sekou Sundiata is one of the fathers of the spoken word movement. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the year that nearly killed him. He had kidney failure, a kidney transplant, and then on the way to his comeback concert, he was in a car accident and broke his neck. That year is the subject of his new performance. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.